This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. When Ronald Reagan left office, he left with the highest approval rating of any president who left the office alive. Where will President Bush stand when he leaves office next January? Polls conducted over the last few months show Americans disapprove strongly of how George W. Bush is doing his job as president. A poll by CNN and the Opinion Research Corporation conducted at the end of April 2008 pegged the number of Americans voicing disapproval at 71%. Meanwhile, in this race for the White House, Republican and Democratic candidates have voiced admiration for Ronald Reagan. And Reagan was invoked by George W. Bush in his campaign for president in 2000. The Bush campaign and transition team envisioned that George W. Bush would combine his father's kinder and gentler outlook with Reagan's conservatism on taxes and social and foreign policy. Why was Reagan such a popular president? Why does his popularity endure? And has Bush's tenure in office resembled the Reagan Revolution? Would Ronald Reagan have invaded Iraq? Our guest this afternoon is journalist Carl Cannon, co-author of Reagan's Disciple, George W. Bush's Troubled Quest for a Presidential Legacy. Carl Cannon's co-author is his father, the journalist Lou Cannon. Between them, they are the authors of many books. Lou Cannon covered the White House for the Washington Post. He covered Ronald Reagan for 36 years, first as a reporter for the San Jose Mercury News. Our guest, Carl Cannon, recently left the National Journal, where he covered the White House, to cover politics for Reader's Digest. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon. Your questions and comments are invited. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number, 800-222-9455. Reagan's Disciple, George W. Bush's Troubled Quest for a Presidential Legacy, is published by Public Affairs Books. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Carl Cannon, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Celeste.
There seems to be some nostalgia for Ronald Reagan. What do you make of that?
Well, the nostalgia among Republicans is understandable. He's a successful, two-term president, left office, and very popular, and whose popularity actually increased even when he left office. And he didn't leave the way this president is leaving. He left. The party was very strong. He was able to deliver. His vice president, this president's father, was elected to a term. And if you're a Democrat, I imagine many of your listeners are Democrats, there's some nostalgia for Reagan as well. And we, in our book, quote several of them, but that nostalgia seems to be a different kind. It's more like, boy, I thought Reagan was bad, but George W. Bush is so bad. Yeah. I pine for Reagan. So Reagan's sort of benefiting at this point, you know, from both sides.
Yeah, well, Barack Obama has talked about Reagan. Hillary Clinton has talked about Reagan. And John Kerry, as you mentioned in the book, commented favorably about Reagan in 2004 following the president's death. Academic historians, however, gave the 40th president not very good marks when he left office. That's changed. How significantly and why the revision?
Well, the academic historians are an interesting bunch there. This started when Arthur Schlesinger, about 50 years ago, decided to rank the presidents. And he was an eminent historian at Harvard, and he called all his friends, and they ranked the presidents. It was no surprise. The great presidents were Lincoln. The greatest presidents were Lincoln and Washington and Roosevelt. And at some point, there wasn't a big conservative media then, but some people noticed that all of Arthur Schlesinger, all his friends were Democrats, and maybe this thing had a liberal tilt to it. So there have been other things over the years. The Wall Street Journal put together a group of historians that wasn't conservative historians. It had liberal, independent, and conservative historians. And no surprise, Washington and Lincoln are still the best presidents, and Roosevelt's on the list. But when you add conservative academics, some of them slip Reagan into the great or near great category. But again, now, you know, we learn things as history goes on. Now the end of the Cold War, the end of the Clinton administration and the second Bush administration, even liberal historians are starting to elevate Reagan some. Sean Wilentz, the great historian from Princeton, he's got a new book out, and I guess I'm on the show to plug my own book, not his book, but why not? And Sean was a guy, you may remember, Celeste, he showed up at the impeachment hearings for Clinton and excoriated the Republicans for impeaching Bill Clinton. But he is taking another look at Reagan, too. And part of that reason is we learn things. You know, the voters are voting, they're choosing between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama or John McCain. They're thinking of very much of George W. Bush and of Bill Clinton. That's what's in their mind, and they want the success of those presidents and not their failures. But historians have, you know, president. When we talk about presidential legacy, it's a trickier thing because presidents are judged by who succeeded them in office, something that they can't possibly know even. And so Reagan looks better, I think, even to some liberals. You know, he didn't, nothing approaching a sex scandal. He did not invade. You know, the guy who was parodied as a mad bomber when he ran showed great restraint in foreign policy. He didn't invade Iraq, you know, as both the Bushes have fought wars against Saddam. And so I think he looks better to people now, partly because of his restraint in foreign policy.
Yeah. Would Ronald Reagan have invaded Iraq? How did the people you interviewed for the book answer that question?
Well, this is funny. My dad, you know, you're writing a book with your dad. He's such an, you know, acclaimed journalist. You have to be a little bit deferential. But he called me one day and he said, you know what we need to know? I said, what? He said, we need to know, before we answer the question of Reagan invaded Iraq, would Woodrow Wilson have invaded Iraq? I'll admit this struck me as a little esoteric, but it wasn't, because, you know, Wilsonianism is used as a slur no matter what you're criticizing George W. Bush for. Naivete, warmongering, whatever side you're on. He's not the first. Wilson gets criticized, and of course he gets criticized because he couldn't get the League of Nations through, and he dispatched American troops to the, quote, the war to end all wars, which World War I most definitely was not. And so there's this idea that you're animated by these great causes, but you're not realistic. But anyway, we looked into that, and we decided, no, there's no. Wilson was very specific. He didn't say America would make, you know, the world safe for democracy. He said so that the world must be made safe for democracy. He even used the passive voice. Wilson went to great lengths to keep the United States out of World War I and was very chary about those kinds of involvements and didn't get us involved in a Balkans war and had all kinds of things that he didn't do. And we ended up concluding that even Wilson wouldn't have done this war, let alone Reagan. And the people said that we interviewed, including people who worked for both presidents, that what they appreciated about Reagan, even if they didn't at the time, was his realism, and that Reagan would have asked tough questions about how hard this was going to be.
How did Reagan manage his advisors, cabinet members, and vice president, and then how would you describe Bush's relationships with those folks, with the vice president, cabinet, and staff?
Can I take the vice presidential question first and separate that for a minute? And you'll see why as I answer it. One of the chapters in the book is a chapter I wrote. It's called The NBA President. And it's about, and I don't dwell on Dick Cheney much in this, but it's about, you know, this president's the first president we've had who had an MBA. And, that, you know, this has been a long time fantasy, not just of conservatives, but of everyday Americans. Boy, get government working like a business. And here was a guy who had a master's degree from Harvard in business. And you know, I was actually at Harvard last year for one semester teaching a course at the Kennedy School on the press and the presidency. And they had me housed at the business school, and I was curious. I remember thinking, what did George W. Bush, when he was a student here, what did he learn about management that they're no longer teaching? What did he not learn that he thought he learned? You know, and I was just curious. Well, I asked all these questions, and it turned out to be something that not quite the right questions. But it got me onto the management structure of his White House. And the key component of it, in hindsight, is that Dick Cheney was really this uber chief of staff. And he did that by design, and the president who wanted help governing let him do it. And not to criticize those two unduly, because people, including me in the press, and people like Paul Light at the Brookings Institution, who study government management, thought this was a good government thing. And I went to see Dick Cheney. My father and I had lunch with him in 2003 at what might really be the high water mark of the Bush presidency in terms of perceived success and polls. And I asked him, you know, I said, I was doing a piece on the evolution of the vice presidency. And I said, how long, you know, when Truman became president, he'd only met with Roosevelt alone a couple of times. You know, he wasn't really ready to be president. He didn't know much about the atom bomb. He didn't know what Stalin had been promised by Roosevelt at Yalta. And Cheney, and I said, how many times have you met alone with the president? And Cheney pulled this piece of paper out of his coat, and he said, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 times today. Mm. And, you know, I kind of said, wow. And he said, you know, I'm just there for the guy. Everybody knows I'm not running for president. I can just be there for him. And I have to tell you, Celeste, I thought, like I say, everybody I know, David Broder and all, everybody, liberals, Democrats, everybody thought, no, that makes sense. This is the natural evolution of the vice presidency. Well, I think it wasn't. I think it was the over-evolution of the office. I think what we've learned in the ensuing 5 years is the perils of it. Cheney went on and said to my father and I, you know, I don't have to worry about some Republican chairman from Colorado calling me. I don't have to worry about the Iowa fundraiser. I'm just there for the president. Again, it sounded good, but it wasn't. And I'm sorry I'm going on too long with this answer, but I think it wasn't for three reasons. And the first was is that if the vice president is a constitutional officer, he can't really be removed. You know, the president doesn't have to run with him again. And in fact, that's what Roosevelt did in 1944 so that Truman became president. But you can't really remove him. So, you know, that's a problem. That what does that make Bush? Not really the CEO, sort of the chairman of the board. And then the second thing is that if he's the chairman of the board, then if the guy's the CEO, he's really the uber chief of staff. When the guy who was supposed to be the chief of staff, Andy Card, went to the president and said, you need to remove Don Rumsfeld. He did this forcefully in 2004. Well, if the chief of staff, the real chief of staff, does that in the White House, you've got a problem. You probably have to remove him or the head of the Pentagon. You've got a problem. But he wasn't really the chief of staff. Cheney was really the chief of staff, and Cheney was saying, no, we keep Rumsfeld. So what does that make Card? Well, it makes him, I don't know, the deputy chief of staff or the body man or something else, something lesser. And you see how that affects the whole arrangements in the White House. It makes them impracticable, and really everything gets funneled through the vice president. And it makes, and I don't, a chairman of the board, a commander chief can't be a chairman of the board. He has to be hands-on. And the third thing I'll say is that the system has evolved politically so that a vice president should want to run again. You know, he has his mind to the grassroots. If Dick Cheney had been calling that chairman from Colorado on that fundraiser in Iowa, you know what he'd have heard? He would have heard, you know, you better not come out here. You're not popular. Why? Because all the National Guard's people have been called up, and we don't know when they're coming home. And the guy in Colorado said, because this war is bankrupting us, and the economic conservatives don't like it. And it turns out that the system has evolved. It had evolved up to a point that made sense. And that is, the vice president should want to run, and his ear to the grassroots helps the president govern. And all of these things were absent in this administration. And so what you had was a series of things where people weren't really in the jobs they appeared to be in, and what seemed to be a well-run ship was actually kind of chaotic. I apologize for that long answer, but that's how we see it, and that's where we came out.
Carl Cannon is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He's a journalist. He and his father, journalist Lou Cannon, are the authors of Reagan's Disciple, George W. Bush's Troubled Quest for a Presidential Legacy. My name is Celeste Quinn. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Listeners, you can join us with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's take some calls now. Our first caller this afternoon, a listener in Champaign County, line one. Hi.
Hi. On this current subject, I can't understand why none of the Republicans complain about Cheney not bowing out halfway through the second term or something and grooming someone. It seems like it would have been a logical thing to do. He could have still been the Svengali. They could have made a position for him where he could even met even more quietly with the commander-in-chief, as it were. But I wanted to loop back to what you were saying about Reagan, because I don't think Reagan would have any compunctions if it about invading Iraq if it was characterized as, you know, necessary for continuing American hegemony in the Middle East, which people point at the way he pulled out of Lebanon so quickly after some precursor organization of Hezbollah blew up the Marine barracks. But the reason I say that is because he had no compunctions about fighting proxy wars all over the country, defying Congress with the Boland Amendment, the Clark Amendment. Clark Amendment's not as well known about, but that's the proxy war that went on in Angola, and the frontline states were, you know, hundreds of thousands of people were killed, not directly by U.S. military, but if all you're worried about is, you know, U.S. direct forces, maybe he would have been more clever and found some way to find somebody else to do it, I suppose, but I don't think that actually is realistic. So I don't think Reagan would have had any compunctions about it. He might have done a better job selling it, I suppose, though I'm not confident of that either. But this lionizing of Reagan is so ahistoric. I'm going to be dismissed as the the fringe element, but one need only read the some of this history, and you know, Reagan authorized pretty much trading arms with you know, Iran, making a deal. He had no compunctions. I'll
Carl Cannon.
Reply.
Carl Cannon, you want to jump in?
Well, I urge this caller to read our book. We back up all of our conclusions with, you know, some reasoned argument and footnotes, and I don't expect everyone's going to agree with us, but I don't think our book lionizes Reagan, and we can talk critically about Lebanon. But I will tell this caller something, and your listeners something they may not know, which is that the invasion of Panama that nobody talks about anymore, that George H.W. Bush affected in replacing Manuel Noriega, whatever one thinks of that, whether it was good or bad, Reagan was asked to do it very strenuously and refused. At some point, we found in the notes, George Shultz's notes, I think it was Ed Meese said, he was then Attorney General, told the president, you know, law enforcement is for this. And Reagan said, well, Ed, that makes me think less of law enforcement. Reagan asked all these kind of questions. The questions are whether things could go bad, and he had this phrase he liked to use, that we would be perceived as the Colossus of the North. And although, you know, the United States, the Reagan administration is remembered in its last 2 years for getting in trouble for violating the Boland Amendment, and for listeners who aren't aware of it, that was congressional appropriations rider that prohibited the United States from funding the Contras in Nicaragua, and the administration violated that and paid a price for it. But Reagan was very careful about committing American troops, and that was the question. I'm not here to defend his public his foreign policy, or other people can do that if they want, but I'm here to answer your question, Celeste, and there's really no evidence that Reagan, in my opinion, that Reagan would have launched a huge land war in Iraq.
Let's take another call, a listener in Urbana on line 3. Hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I think that George Bush is, in effect, a disciple of Reagan in following through on ideas that Reagan began in three areas. One, Reagan began to distance the Republican Party from activities to provide civil rights for active African Americans, which began way back in the Lincoln administration and was later revitalized in the Eisenhower administration. Number two, he forsook the heritage of, or the yeah, the heritage of the Theodore Roosevelt administration in conservation of natural resources and later pollution control of which evolved during the Eisenhower and Ford administrations. And thirdly, ignored President Eisenhower's warning about the military-industrial complex. I believe the example from the Reagan era was the ridiculous 600-ship Navy, which is was a number somebody pulled out of a hat somewhere. Any comments on any of those examples?
I didn't understand the civil rights example. I understand what you were saying.
Well, when Reagan was in office, there was great controversy when he started appointing people especially in the civil rights division in the Department of Justice, who were really not interested in civil rights all that much. I forget the man's name, but there was quite a controversy then, and I don't think George W. Bush is terribly interested in the civil rights movement in the modern time, even though a lot of people don't think there's any reason for it anymore. But there was a lot of jokes around that it wasn't so bad to be a Klansman when Ronald Reagan was president. Can't remember anything specifics about that stuff, but
I don't know how to even respond to that. But let me tell you what we wrote in our book, and let me respond briefly to what you said.
Okay.
In our book, we said that if Bush was Reagan's disciple, and remember he ran in 2000 as a conservative, he didn't run as a liberal, so you may not want to vote for him under any circumstances, but he wanted the votes Reagan got, which is understandable because when Reagan ran for re-election, he got 58% of the vote and won in a landslide. So he tried to be that. And one of the things he said he wanted to do was appoint judges like Reagan would have appointed. Well, his Supreme Court appointees are even more conservative than Reagan's. And if you're a conservative, that's a good thing. He said he would cut taxes, and he delivered on that pledge and fooled around with the tax code so that it was progressive enough. You had a whole other group. He really built on what Bill Clinton had did. You had a whole number of group of the working class who didn't pay any taxes at all under the Bush plan, and middle class taxes cut. Of course, taxes got cut for the rich too, which is not popular and maybe not even sensible.
Absolutely.
But he did deliver on that. So if you were Reagan, if you liked Reagan, you would have liked what he did on taxes. And those two areas, he was. And I would submit to you in a third area, he wasn't successful, but on immigration policy, he has a kind of enlightened approach to immigration, which by the time the bill came up, because he was fooling around with Social Security in Iraq, he had nobody would follow him, even in his own party. But his policies on that were very much like Reagan's. So I think in those three areas, he could claim to be Reagan's disciple. As for the sort of negative examples you look, I think the environmental thing is certainly a fair point. Do you remember Lynn Nofziger, who was a political director for Reagan briefly? Reagan, I came from California. I was once interviewing him, and I said, I phrased the question probably not much different than you would have. I was a young reporter, you know, and full of myself. And I said, Lynn, when did it become, you know, great Republican doctrine to befoul the nation's air and water? You know, he threw me out of his office, but your point's well taken there.
Thank you.
I think on civil rights, I'll just be honest with you. I speak to Bush more than Reagan on this. I don't think that's really a very fair criticism. And I have to tell you, the nation, you know, this president tackled a couple of issues that one was a good liberal issue, and other liberals wouldn't touch. But they really are liberal themes. And the first one was education. You know, George Miller. Do you know who George Miller is? Yeah, congressman I used to cover from California.
Vaguely.
Very big House liberal on education. And he went down to Austin, Texas to see Bush in 1999, and he said, you know, I'm here because you used a phrase, and it's jargony, but he says, you know, you said you'd disaggregate the data. What that means is this testing of school children where African-American children do so much more poorly. And Bush said flatly, that's inexcusable. And Miller came down there, and later Ted Kennedy supported him in this effort. And he said, you know, this is going to cost money, what you want to do. And Bush said, I'll spend money on that. It was one of the funny things during the campaign of the re-election 2004. The Annenberg School at the University of Pennsylvania does this fact-checking thing. And, of course, the candidates, you know, spin wildly and brag. You know, that's the nature of our politics these days. But this was one area where Bush actually underestimated what he'd done. He said he'd raised spending for education, federal spending, 54%. It was actually like 56%. And most of that money went to, you know, was intended for districts with, you know, children who weren't measuring up. And the other thing is, you know, he proposed vast increases and delivered on most of them. AIDS spending in Africa. He said he tripled the budget. That's an exaggeration, but he more than doubled it over the Clinton. He doubled in 4 years what Clinton had done in eight. And I just think that if you're a good liberal and you care about these issues, you want to be fair-minded, those are points in his favor.
I don't mind being corrected.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm not perfect either. But I just on those two issues, on that issue of race, I think this president has been pretty good.
How about the military industrial
well,
complex?
Yeah,
working
yeah, that,
from Eisenhower.
That goes without saying that you're right.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Carl Cannon, our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He's a journalist. He and his father, who's also a journalist, Lou Cannon, are the authors of Reagan's disciple George W. Bush's troubled quest for a presidential legacy. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, anywhere else toll-free, 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. This goes back a ways now, but I would like you to talk about it a little bit in terms of what led George W. Bush into politics and how did he evolve from when he first got into politics in the 1970s? How has he, what have been the pivotal moments in his career?
Excuse me. That's an interesting question. People don't ask it much anymore, but, you know, this president, he's the only one of his of these Bush kids, Marvin and Neil and Jeb and their sister Doro, who's not born in Texas, and he's the most Texas of the group, and everybody admits that, whether they like Bush or hate him, and that's a funny thing because when the first time he ran, he was this guy who'd gone to Yale, he'd been to Harvard, he'd come back, he'd gone in the oil business, and he ran for the House and lost. And he ran against a guy who was a Democrat, but a Southern, you know, boll weevil type Democrat, and who painted him as not authentically Texan and kind of an effete snob, and said that other effete snob, non-Texas, Karl Rove, was working for him. Now, doesn't that take you back? Well, you know, George Wallace, after he lost in Alabama, famously said, you know, I'll never be out-segged again, as in segregation. Well, he probably used to worse word, but I think what Bush said, and there's some evidence for it, I interviewed some people for the book, Bush said, I'll never be out Texan again, and he wasn't, and he became, sort of remade himself into this good old boy conservative, not his father's party, and, you know, 2 years after this defeat, his father lost to Reagan, but then was surprisingly picked as Reagan's vice president, and there's speeches I've heard Bush giving to the Midland Rotary Club. I've gone back and looked at transcripts of it. No, they weren't transcripts, excuse me. No, press clippings. And he's always expressing this early admiration for Reagan. But the admiration seems to be Reagan's a winner. And I think early on, George W. Bush decides he's going to do what it takes to position himself to run in this post-Ronald Reagan Republican Party. And Reagan had really remade the party. And he drifts rightward, and he becomes a born again Christian. I do not imply that that's an inauthentic conversion, but he becomes this kind of person who can run from Texas and win there. But at the same time, this unifier thing is not wrong in Texas. He's known. He talks to the Democrats. He gets his a minimalist agenda, but he gets it through. He gets it through a Democratic legislature. And he comes here in 2000 promising to be a uniter, not a divider, not criticizing Bill Clinton the way other people in his party were. And I think people here thought he was going to govern differently.
Hmm. Has he been a careful student of history at all, or has he been a careful student of the way politics is played?
Well, you know, I remember thinking about this when I covered Bill Clinton. And these presidents, they read histories. They read books, even, you know, famously non-intellectual presidents, and famously, you know, Bill Clinton, who was the intellectuals, read all these murder mysteries, and George Bush sort of hides the fact that he's reading Nathan Sharansky. It's kind of weird. But they both read, they tend to read books about history, but they don't read them, Celeste, the way you and I would read them. They don't read them for the lessons. They read them selectively to justify what they're already doing. This is something I've picked up, and I think it's hard to be a student of history when you're making history. And in the case of President Bush, the current President Bush, he still thought you know, he was doing what Reagan would do, even after it was obvious in some instances that he wasn't. And, you know, this rhetoric that Bush uses, freedom is not America's gift to the world, it's God's gift to every man and woman in the world. Well, that's the way other presidents have talked. That's not New Testament. That's Thomas Jefferson. That's natural rights, okay? But this realism that goes with that, John Adams, our previous caller warned about Eisenhower. Well, but Jefferson and Adams and George Washington, the first three presidents, all warned about the danger of entangling foreign alliances and trying to affect democracy around the globe at the point of a gun. This is something the founders knew at the start, that the soaring rhetoric of ours, you can get carried away with it. It can sound messianic, and what you always have to have is a dose of realism in that rhetoric. And it seems to me that the great presidents always understood that you have to marry this very wonderful rhetoric about the American dream and the beauty of freedom with a realism of how the world works and what's possible. And Roosevelt and Reagan and Eisenhower, Kennedy always did that.
Mm. George W. Bush has compared himself to Harry Truman, saying that Truman's post-war foreign policy is similar to his foreign policy. Is that a fair comparison?
Well, Truman is he's the patron saint of beleaguered presidents. That, in his last 2 years in office, Clinton must have mentioned Truman 50 times. And this guy does the same thing. Look, he comes into office, he wants to be Reagan. Not even his father. He wants to be better than his own dad. I think his father will probably be thought of as a pretty successful president, but he wants to be Reagan. Then the Democrats say, oh, this guy ain't Reagan, he's Hoover, he's Grant, he's James Buchanan, he's the worst president we ever had. So this is Bush's attempt to scale down and, okay, can I be Hoover? You know, can I be Truman? But the analogy makes some sense. I wouldn't say it exactly the way the president says it. But Truman left office, you know, the lowest approval ratings ever recorded. Lower than, he was in Nixon and Carter territory, lower than Carter, Nixon territory. His own party didn't want to campaign with him. He got us involved in this war that seemed to have no end in Korea. There was corruption in his own party. And he left office, nobody would even be seen with him. Well, 20 years later, the Truman Renaissance starts, and 50 years later, Truman's this guy that he's iconic president that presidents of both parties cite. So, can Bush do that? I have no idea. I can't see into the future, but I understand why he reaches out for this life raft called the USS Harry Truman.
Hmm. One of the things you say about the president in the book is that he and his advisors seem unable to remember the past, even the immediate past. Would you tell us about the president's turnaround on comparing Iraq with Vietnam?
Yeah, well, initially, in fact, in Afghanistan, it thinks, commentators who didn't approve of it compared to, this could be a quagmire. Then Iraq, 3 days into it, it's a quagmire. Johnny Apple, late, great Johnny Apple, writing the Times a week into it, it's a quagmire. And they ridiculed this, The Bush administration and their loyalists said, how can you possibly compare it? This thing is nothing like it. And they said that this was going to be fast, and it was going to be not easy, but it was going to happen, and the Iraqi people would embrace democracy. And then when it turned out to be something different, then they started saying, then they started using Vietnam. They really criticized harshly people who use this analogy, but then as the thing slogged to an end, they reached for an old conservative canard that, wait, Vietnam, we didn't lose it on the battlefield, we lost it at home. Well, I'm not going to relitigate all that, and we don't in our book, but the point is that they use this history selectively to justify what they're doing without sometimes stopping and think how it's going to sound to others. And they're not alone among White Houses that do that, but it's pretty stark when there's a war on.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit before time runs out about the Cold War and the dissolution of the Soviet Union. That was on Reagan's watch. And then maybe you could talk a little bit about that, Reagan and Gorbachev, and then maybe you'd talk a little bit about your thoughts about Bush and Putin and the Bush administration's changing relations with Russia.
Well, you'd mentioned Truman. The problem with comparing yourself to Truman the way Cheney and Bush have is that they, in their analogy, they're going to fight, they're going to open the war against Islam fanaticism. They're going to wage it, and they're going to win it all in one presidency. Well, then, if you think about the analogy with the Cold War, and they've made that analogy, then Bush isn't Truman. He's every president from Truman to his dad. And so that, if you phrase it that way, you see how unrealistic it was to begin with. And so the lessons of the Soviet Union, I think, are these things take time. Every president deserves credit for the end of the Cold War. Does Reagan deserve more credit than the others? More than some of them. I wouldn't say more than Truman, but a lot. And he called the Soviets out. He spent all this money that, you know, ran up our deficit, but also it bankrupted the Russians, and they finally threw in the towel. So he gets some credit for that, for seeing that. Reagan never had any illusion about the Russians. And so in his day, he's being pushed hard to be tough on first of all, Brezhnev and Gorbachev, you know, all of them. And finally, he tells his speechwriters, he says, look, I got to do business with these people. And they would always put in the stuff in the speeches, and some of the moderates on the staff would be taking it out. They were called pragmatists, and there was this big tussle in Reagan. But Reagan himself set the tone. And the great phrase, trust but verify, it's one of the great slogans ever coined, because it shows you you're willing to try and negotiate, but you're not going to be naive. When Bush goes and meets Putin and says, I don't remember the exact language, but we all remember sort of the gist of it. You know, I looked in his eyes. Mm-hmm. He has a soul. It's something Reagan never would have said, never even thought. And I think all leaders, Reagan included, over-personalize the relationships with other leaders, and it's an understandable impulse. There's who else can I talk to, really, as a peer? But, boy, you don't want to go too far with that, because, you know, if you look in, somebody else could look in Putin's soul and see a KGB thug. Well, Bush has acknowledged privately, by the way, that he shouldn't have said that, and that he misjudged Putin. But there's a cost to those kind of misjudgments. I think the country sent signals early on that we weren't attentive to what was going on in Russia, which is in some ways, you know, the retrenchment of the old Soviet attitudes.
What are your thoughts about this administration's rhetoric and policy toward Iran? And then maybe we can bring it up to the current campaign and what we've heard from the candidates, what they're saying about Iran, U.S.-Iranian relations.
You know, Celeste, Iran is such a problem. Think about Hillary Clinton saying the other day casually, you know, she'll blow them up, you know, she'll destroy Iran if they destroy Israel. I mean, that's not so much a well-thought-out position as a statement of frustration. No one knows what to do with Iran. And one thing is clear to me, if you had not had this invasion of Iraq, this president would have been able to deal more forcefully with Iran. The idea that a country is developing nuclear weapons and occasionally its leaders will sort of casually talk about bombing Israel or eliminating the whole country of Israel, it's a frightening thing. And we're going to look back on this time, if we're not careful, and really rue the day that we didn't take it more seriously. One of the problems is that we're bogged down. We've got two wars going on, one in Afghanistan, one in Iraq. This country, the military is oversubscribed. There's not much we can do. And the moral currency in the world has been used. We are stretched thin. And the United States can't do much with Iran. It's a huge problem that the next president is going to inherit. And they all, three of them, know it.
Yeah. Well, share with us some of your thoughts on this campaign, where we are at the moment in mid-May in the 2000 campaign for the White House.
Well, you know, I'll say the obvious first. It's the most exciting campaign in many years. The idea that you would have the first serious female presidential candidate, and she's old hat. Why is she old hat? Because an African-American president is running and apparently winning, and he's not only ahead in all the ways we can measure, he's really excited the young generation. We did a poll at Reader's Digest recently. It's out in this new issue, in fact, and I guess like today. And these young voters are really excited about Barack Obama, not just the University of Illinois, not just in Illinois where he's the senator, but all over this country. This guy, we did a mock matchup, him against McCain, Hillary Clinton against McCain, she beats McCain about 10 points, about the generic Democrat, about what Kerry did over, these are under 30 voters. Barack Obama beats McCain with this group by 22 or 23 points. It's a generational difference we've never had. He has really excited the group. And it's a group that is into aspirational politics and community service and multilateral solutions to problems and the greening of America. They're an amazing, really, group generation, these young people. They're optimistic and altruistic, and they work hard, and they want to change things. And, you know, John McCain was an aspirational candidate when he ran in 2000, and he may yet be, because he called for compulsory community service, American public service. If you're not in the military, do something good. He sponsored bills. So you have, if it's Barack Obama versus McCain, you have two candidates who are both aspirational. One will claim to be like Reagan, McCain. The other will drop polite hints like Barack Obama's that, you know, that McCain, that Reagan's not Reagan. We have things to learn from Reagan, and they'll both be attempting to tap into that optimistic spirit that I associate in my lifetime with John F. Kennedy and Ronald Reagan both.
Let's see if we can take another call or two before we're out of time. Listener in Urbana on line one. Let's go there. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, going back to Iran, and first I would say I'm no admirer of the present regime, but it seems that Bush, to me at least, is an excellent model for how not to deal with Iran. At least twice, when it appeared more progressive groups were threatening to come into power, he has done exactly the opposite, exactly the wrong thing. The David Frum speech, what was it? Not the triangle of evil. The
axis of evil.
Axis of evil was just the sort of thing that the ultra-conservatives needed to rally the populace behind them and to threaten the more progressive groups, and they decisively defeated him. And once later, when it appeared that the progressives were going to get an upper hand, again Bush threatened Iran, when it would have been much better not to say anything. And the insistence on never speaking or dealing with the Iranians is simply insane. They're there. We don't have to make big concessions, but there's nothing to be lost in talking to them. And I think we have to remember that these extremely truculent statements that occasionally come out of the Iranian government usually don't come out of the people who really hold power. It's a strange system, but the president who is most truculent actually doesn't have nearly so much power as one might think from his title.
Let's let the guest respond now.
Well, that's a much more sanguine view of Iran that I hold. I actually hope the caller's right, but I fear that he's wrong. I don't think the progressive groups were ever in danger of taking power in Iran, but I like to be optimistic. So, sir, I'll go with you, but I don't see it that way. But I hope it's that way, because the next president's going to have to deal with them.
Let's take our last caller this afternoon in Geneva, Illinois, line four. Hi.
Hey, good afternoon. You know what? I kind of disagree with a lot of what you say. I tell you, I go. Maybe I'm an oddball when it comes to who I vote for. But I vote for experience over somebody who's new, especially from a guy that's in it from Illinois and has done absolutely nothing. People need to start looking at the records. And I guess we don't. I guess that's the reason why we're in such a mess. Barack Obama hasn't really voted for a lot of things, and the ones that he has, it really hasn't done much for anybody. Now, I see this being a generational thing. I see this the new generation against the older generation, because that's the way it seems to be stacking up. And the problem, I like Barack Obama and what he says. The biggest thing that people have to worry about that I see, and that we always get stung on this 99% of the time, is what they say and what they do are two different things, far from what's going on. And that's the biggest problem that I see with this country, is they don't look and who really makes the decisions. It's not the President of the United States. It's the Congress and the Senate of the United States. Once we start looking at that, maybe we'll get some decent people. I don't know why we keep voting for the same guys. We need to go down the middle with everything, because otherwise we'll be talking about this another 2 years, guarantee you.
Okay, let Carl Kinnon respond.
Well, I don't remember saying, I hope I didn't say I was voting for Barack Obama. I was just trying to explain his appeal to, but you know, there's going to be a lot of voters like this caller who's going to their head's going to tell them McCain and their heart's going to tell them Obama, but one of them's going to be president. And I think what we've learned in the past administration and the past several administrations is, you know, you don't always know what the issues are going to be. Nobody talked about 9/11 in the 2000 campaign because it hadn't happened yet. And I guess I would submit that we all ought to vote for people that make us comfortable about their character and judgment, and because we don't always know what they're going to have to face.
So you think Hillary Clinton is out?
I've been real agnostic about that, but math is a hard thing to argue against. It looks to me like Obama's going to be the nominee.
There we have to leave it. We're out of time. Carl Kinnon, thanks for talking with me this afternoon and our listeners.
All right. Thank you.
Carl Kinnon and Lou Kinnon are the authors of Reagan's Disciple, George W. Bush's Troubled Quest for a Presidential Legacy, the publisher, Public Affairs.